Young men are supposed to have sex. Young men are supposed to have sex and get drunk and sleep in on Sunday morning till brunch. Young men aren't supposed to read philosophy between the ages of 22 and 30. Young men are supposed to be callow and cavalier about things that later they will have to think are important. Young men, young men, young men. The world is supposed to open like an oyster. The world is supposed to open like an oyster. The world is supposed to be ours. I don't want to be the one who wastes precious time. The one who has no fun while I'm in my prime. Before I'm done, there will be dancing and girls. Oh, I don't want to pledge my brain to some college town. Before I've had a chance to look around. Locked up a domain in a cap and gown. That isn't the reason you go to Brown. Or Wesleyan or other schools young men attend.
With us this afternoon, we have a special guest. Alex Timbers is here talking with us. Broadway fans know Alex from way back at the Jersey Boys or Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, the Pee Wee Herman show, which I wasn't sure I knew about that, and Peter and the Starcatcher and Rocky most recently. So, Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, tell me, so we're recording on, I would say, Friday the 20th. Of June, have you decompressed from the Tony Award craziness?
Oh yeah, I mean it's great. I've been up on the countryside for a couple of weeks, so it was wonderful. I got to watch the Tonys on TV, and it was great. It's so wonderful to see so many cool musicals get to perform this year.
So you're doing that now. You're decompressing from the countryside. You've just finished up with Rocky. What's next for you? What's going on?
Next up, we're going to London to the National Theatre to do Here Lies Love, which is a show about Imelda Marcos that is running right now in New York. And we're actually going to get to cast this partially out of the Philippines in London. So next up is a trip to Manila, believe it or not.
Wow. So you're really getting back to the root of it. You're not even going to fake any of that, but you're going right to the place where people know Imelda Marcos the best.
Yeah. It's going to be really cool. I'm very interested to see how people react to the show there. And, I think it'll be a pretty extraordinary experience. The writer of the show, David Byrne's, been there a bunch, but I've never visited.
And so what's the time frame for that project to come together in London?
So that'll happen this fall. And we're going to be reopening their third space. It's going to be called the Dorfman now, and it will have two balconies, and we're going to it'll be just like the same sort of immersive nightclub experiences as is happening right now at the Public Theater.
So your relationship with the Public Theater goes back how long?
Till about, we started developing Andrew Jackson about midway through probably 2008 with them. And Oscar Eustace, I mean, I just think the world of him, and he's been a terrific supporter of the shows that I've done through my company, Le Fer Corbusier. And then, he helped bring me on to Here Lies Love, which sort of eternally grateful for.
So how did you get from your studies at Yale down to the Public Theater on Lafayette Street? Did you have classmates who introduced you to that channel, or did you just get to New York and keep working until eventually you ended up there?
When I graduated from college, my first job was being Lynn Meadows' intern at Manhattan Theater Club.
Oh.
And I think, one of the things they don't really teach you in college is that, people don't let you direct Thornton Wilder at age 22 or at age 30, And so you sort of look around the city and you realize you need to create your own opportunities if you want to be a director. I think there are many different paths to becoming a director, but for me it was to build a downtown theater company and give it a really specific mission so it stood out from other companies. I've really been creating work about historical figures and historical subject matter and irreverent but sort of academic ways. Andrew Jackson is a great example of that. But early on, I created a show about Robert Moses, and there was a show about L. Ron Hubbard done with small children that was really fun. And at the whole time, you know, I was like, wow, you know, I wish Oscar Eustace would kind of come see these shows. I feel like with what he programs, you might really love this. And then it was really through Andrew Jackson that, you know, which was maybe the seventh or eighth Layfair show that that he became familiar with the company, and that's sort of born fruit. And now we've done Andrew Jackson together, and we did Love Liggers Last this last summer in the park, which my company helped develop. And I just think he's great, and we've been very lucky for that friendship.
So you formed your own production company and went about into Andrew Jackson. So you have the ability to do pretty much anything that you want. You're creating your own opportunities. So Aileen had a question that was specifically about this. So Aileen, why don't you take over?
Please.
Actually, I think it was Laura's question, but I'll steal it. We were just wondering if you could adapt anything into a musical right now, what would it be?
Oh, that's a really good question. I don't have like a believe it or not, a sort of a long list, but I've always wanted to do to take a concept album and put it on stage. I mean, one of the things that for me was a really watershed moment in terms of falling in love with theater was seeing Des McAnuff's production of The Who's Tommy at the St. James. I guess getting to do a show with like Brandon Flowers from The Killers or something like that, that would be, you know, an extraordinary experience. But I don't right now have like a book that leaps off that I'm like, we need to bring this into three dimensions quite yet.
So you said that The Who's Tommy was one of your first shows that you saw?
Yeah, well, it was one of the first shows I really fell in love with because it said to me that there's not such, there doesn't have to be a gulf between theater and popular culture. To me, you know, that theater often feels something that's rarefied. And it can at times feel snobby and elitist. You know, I think we can all see that. Not all theaters like that. But with Tommy, I was like, here's something that's using the kind of visuals of music videos, the kind of the music that you might hear on a radio. And it's doing something really cool, and it's bringing in a traditional Broadway audience, but it's also bringing in a new audience. And that to me was really eye-opening. And then when Des the next year directed How to Succeed with Matthew Broderick, I was like, wow, like one guy can do both those shows, you know, that seems so different. For me, as a young person, I was like, wow, that sounds like an exciting profession.
So, if you had to choose between writing and directing, what would you choose, or would you create a hybrid?
Well, I definitely consider myself a director and not really a writer. You know, I've written a couple things and adapted some things, but it's most of those situations were born out of just not knowing like who the right writer to go to was for them. You know, I'm not precious about my own work, but I'm great to collaborate with because I will happily rewrite myself or have someone else rewrite me. But I think the best part about my experience of being a writer is that it's allowed me to collaborate well with real professional writers. You know, I think it allows me to sort of dialogue with them well and be sort of empathic and sensitive to their process. And also I've learned a great deal about structure and character through actually having sort of that sort of boots on the ground experience of writing.
It's really funny to hear you say that you don't think of yourself very much as a writer, because I think like in particular, the book of Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson was one of the most eye-opening experiences of saying like, we can speak in a really modern language and sort of close the gap between the way people, particularly young people, communicate today and the way that people communicate their story on a stage in the theater. And like, that has some of the best jokes that, you know, the best, smartest, coolest jokes that we've, I think, ever heard. So I can't imagine not thinking of yourself as a writer.
No, thank you. Well, I take partial credit for that, but it's also, you know, about having an open rehearsal process with your actors and the designers, and so that if anyone has a really good idea for a line or a better idea for a line, you know, happy to sort of incorporate that. And I think it gives everyone that's working on the show a sense of ownership over it, but it also allows, you know, allows for the best work. So I feel partially responsible for that book, but I really, I credit to, you know, all the people that worked on the workshops and the readings with us as well. So, but thank you.
What was your favorite joke in that show?
Oh, you know, I was just, I don't know if it made it into the end show, but there was a great line with Lil Lincoya who plays, Andrew Jackson's, but he's the orphan that Andrew Jackson adopts, and he's a Native American child, and Jackson's forced to sort of like slaughter his family. And at the end of the show, when Jackson's down and out, Lincoya tries to give him some like sort of like sage wisdom, and he says, you know, he tells Jackson, he goes, you know, don't go chasing waterfalls, please stick to the rivers and the lakes that you're used to. And it was, you know, Andrew Jackson didn't quite know what to do with that information, but it was a sort of like it was simultaneously really kind of like deeply emotional and also like dumb and silly, which I like.
We like that joke too.
So that did make it into the end production, right?
Oh yes, it did.
Yeah, I think it might have been moved earlier, but it definitely was in the show because I think I almost fell out of my seat at the Public when that happened.
Oh, good, good. I love that.
So, Laura, did you have a question for Alex about something, some publication here, Peterton?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we don't often see Hal Prince in the pages of Vogue, and you have actually been in Vogue several times. So what was that like, and how do you feel about that sort of stuff in general?
You know, it's a really cool experience that the people at Vogue have been really nice about the shows I've worked on, and both were sort of nice experiences. I find every time you do a photo shoot with an actor, like I tend to feel incredibly self-conscious and realize why they're really good at what they're doing, because you know they have a sort of a looseness when you have to have a photo taken that I'm completely in absence of. What was really cool about the one we did for Here Lies Love was Amy Leibovitz took that, and you know, I mean, she's a legend, and so it was just kind of, you know, as like a director, it's cool to watch someone from another medium direct subjects, you know. So that was really neat. We've been very lucky.
Hey, so you have this Love's Labor's Lost original cast recording coming out on Ghostlight, or is it? It's out already. I should say the digital is out on June 3rd. The CD is going to be in stores on July 8th in a few weeks. So,
yeah.
So, what's that like? Is that the ultimate in bringing, you know, CDs back to your old high school roommate, high school classmates, and saying, "Hey, I just wanted to give you this for Christmas."
I'm sure some family members will be getting some cast recordings this year. But you know what's great about it is that you do a show, and you do a show made for the park, you know, so it exists for 4 weeks, and most of the people get to see it except when it rains. And then, you know, the show's over. And the people that got to see it were hopefully feel very lucky they got to see it. And you know, we feel lucky we got to perform it for them. But that could be the end of a show. And what's great about cast recordings is that, you know, I was a high school kid in Illinois, you know, that some high school kid could pick this up and be like, "Oh my God, I love this show. We should put that on at my school." You know, and I know that Andrew Jackson's been performed many, many times. And I think, you know, it's mostly the result of people falling in love with the music. I mean, that's, you don't read a libretto, you know, at a library and say like, "Oh, this is a great script." They really, you know, you fall in love with the music. And so my hope is that, you know, the result of this will be that colleges and high schools end up doing Love's Labor's Lost. And it's not just something that happened for, you know, 4 great weeks in Central Park.
No, it's just theater is so it's so in the moment, and you don't often have something tangible to bring with you. And I find the cast recordings are special to so many people that are part of the process of creation, especially. So it's great.
Yeah,
it's,
and
I was just going to say it's great that somebody ponied up the money for it, because that's usually what the problem is getting enough money together to record stuff, because it's so expensive.
Yeah, and I have a long collaboration with Michael Friedman, who wrote the songs, and we've done a few shows now together. And I just think he's very prolific. He's done many musicals, and for me personally, I think it's one of his best scores, if not the best. And so I'm really glad that people are going to be able to listen to it. And you know, he writes for Andrew Jackson. I think the CD has something like 22 minutes of music or something. You know, it's a very short score, and this one has, you know, something like 24, 26 songs. So it's really, it's epic for Michael, and I think it's extraordinary. And I'm just really glad that people are going to get the experience and enjoy it. We've been listening to it in the car, and it turned out really well. I'm really happy with it.
You don't have a living room you could listen to it in?
I haven't quite. I'm not staying at my own house, so I haven't figured out how to actually use the CD player here.
So tell me, you mentioned that you saw Tommy in town at the St. James in the Big Yellow Theater at the time. Are you from the area, or where are you from?
Yeah, I grew up in New York City in Manhattan, and I went to high school. My parents divorced, and so I went to high school in Illinois, where my dad lives. Before I was really interested in theater, my parents would take me, you know, I saw Cats, I saw Secret Garden, I saw a lot of shows like that. I remember seeing even the kind of short-lived run of Shogun at the Marquee.
Sure.
So I feel like, you know, pretty lucky to have gotten to grow up around that stuff. And I went to an all-boys school in the city. But we nevertheless performed a play each year with male and female characters. So I've played Charles Dickens, but I've also played, the female lead in Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme by Molière. So I run the gamut in my own performances.
So it sounds like your love of theater is from way back. And your parents took you a lot. Are you? Do you have brothers and sisters? Are your parents in the business?
No. My parents aren't in the business, and I'm an only child.
So you just got hooked when they started to take you to Shogun and Secret Garden and Cats and things like that. And what's it like to be, you know, have seen Cats and end up back at the Winter Garden?
Oh, it's really extraordinary to be in the Winter Garden, to be in, you know, it's funny, whenever you find out you're going to be in a theater so far, like when we were in the Jacobs for Andrew Jackson, you're like, oh my gosh, we're in the, you know, this is one of the great Broadway theaters. And, we felt the same way about the Brooks Atkinson, and you feel the same way about the Winter Garden. I think they're kind of all, you know, have these extraordinary histories. But the Winter Garden is particularly special. Just the fact that so few shows in the last 30 years have played in there, you feel really, kind of grateful to be a part of it. And Rocky's such a huge show, and it's such an immersive show. And particularly at the end, there are very few theaters that had the kind of wraparound quality we needed, and the right pitch at the balcony so that everyone could actually see the fighters in the ring when the ring came out into the audience. And so there were very few options of where we were going to be able to be. And so the fact that the Schuberts allowed us to be in the Winter Garden was an extremely sort of like lucky moment in the history of the show.
When you went to the team and you were like, all right, I got it, we're going to slide the boxing ring out into the audience, did everybody look at you like you were crazy, or were they like, yeah, we're on board, let's do it?
You know, strangely enough, everyone was really excited, and it was probably at the first meeting. You know, I saw this reading, and as you do, there are a bunch of directors that go to these readings that are invited to come, and then if they like it, to pitch. And I saw this show, and you know, which I had sort of no expectations about. I thought it might be, you know, quite a bad idea, and I was just blown away by it. And I got, you know, we spent 3 days at the picture collection at the New York Public Library, and I got the first interview, and I wore a suit, and, you know, and I pitched this whole idea of the sort of the vision of the world and what I wanted to do with the script, and you know how I saw the characters and it all taking place. And then the second meeting was once I was hired, was involved different set designers, and I brought in Chris Baraka, and who ended up designing the set and coming up with all these wonderful ideas. And we pitched this idea of the ring coming out, and the final 20 minutes being very much like sort of what Here Lies Love is like at Down at the Public, where you suddenly you're cast as a participant in the drama. And everyone was really, really excited about it, luckily. And the question was just then, how do we do it? And when we were coming to America, you know, there was questions of like, are we going to do that again? Are we going to do what we did in, you know, because the show had its premiere in Germany. Are we going to be able to do this in on Broadway? And thankfully the producers were like, we have to do this. It's, you know, it's a really cool experience. And for this experience, we've drilled into bedrock underneath the Winter Garden to be able to support the stage coming out in the audience and the ring. They've really gone to extraordinary lengths, and I think it pays off.
So before we run, Alex, Laura and Aileen have one signature question that they want to ask you. So which one of you wants to grab that?
Yeah, so this is a really important question, and it is, what is your favorite mid to late 90s pop song?
Mid to late 90s pop song?
Yes.
Oh, gosh. I would say like Lisa Loeb, Stay.
Nice. Nice. That's great. Sums up an entire era.
But so I came of age during that time, so I have many favorite pop songs, but I love that one.
Well, from your left eye to my left eye.
You did not just do that.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us. I want to remind our listeners that you can check out Ghostlight's release of Love's Labor's Lost. How many times, three times past, can you say that? Love's Labor's Lost, which is available at your typical outlets, iTunes or Amazon or things like that, digitally. And also CDs are in stores on July 8th, so coming up soon. And you can check it out at Chickaboom, chickaboom.com. They have two tracks that you can stream and listen to as well. So, Alex, have a wonderful weekend, and we'll speak with you soon.
Okay, thank you guys so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Because I went to work when they went to school. Rich people think I'm a fool because I went to work when they went to school. And every day you hear that all the best things have no price. But then the bankers and politicians don't take that advice. In a rich people's world, I'll let them roll the dice. 'Cause I have the stars, the moon, the sun. I know how to make love, I know how to have fun. And tomorrow when the party's done, I'll get up and mow the lawn. And the rich people will all be gone. With us today, we have Van Kaplan. Van is the co-founder of the National High School Musical Theater Awards and also the stage director for the upcoming ceremony called the Jimmy Awards at the Minskoff this Monday the 30th. So, Van, thank you for joining us.
No, it's my pleasure.
So, I was reading through the information on the Jimmys and on you and everything else. You've got quite a career, you know, producing Broadway shows and the executive producer of the Civic Light Opera in Pittsburgh. Tell us, was your childhood all based in theater as well?
Well, you know, I started doing theater in high school. I was inspired by my drama teacher, Barney Hammond, so many years ago to get involved in the theater. And it was on a trip to New York where I saw my first Broadway play, Jim Dale and Scapino, that changed my life and convinced me I needed to pursue this as a career. And I'm just thrilled to be able to bring that kind of joy into all these kids' lives for the, you know, the National High School Musical Awards and the Jimmy Awards.
So you said you visited New York. Were you from the Pittsburgh area originally?
No, I grew up in Dallas, Texas.
Oh.
My entire family's from Brooklyn, but for some reason in the 1950s, they emigrated to Texas. And I'm the only one in my family that is actually a Texan.
That's great. So, and then you you had this exposure while you were in high school. What did you do with it after that?
Yes, well, you know, while I was in high school, I really got the bug, and I did shows in high school. I auditioned for Juilliard and was accepted into that program. And then I finished up my college education at SMU in Dallas. And right out of college, I was hired at a theater in Fort Worth, Casa Manana Theater, and I was there for 17 years.
Wow. So that's great. And how did you end up producing Broadway productions of Evita, Catch Me If You Can, Clump Fly Away, The Addams Family? You know, how did you make that big leap to the Broadway stage?
Well, I moved to Pittsburgh about 17, 18 years ago to run the Pittsburgh CLO. And at that time, the CLO was very interested in getting into the creation and development of new musicals. And they had raised a bit of money for new work development. So over that period of time, between then and now, we've been involved in about 21 Broadway shows in various different ways as investors, producers, creators, and currently we're working on a very exciting musical, American in Paris, which is going to premiere in Paris very soon. So, you know, we just wanted to give back to the industry, to get involved in the creation of new shows, to eventually have those shows come and play our season in Pittsburgh. And that's been the case on almost all of the shows we've been involved in. In fact, this summer, the national tour of Evita, which I'm one of the producers of, is playing our summer musical season in Pittsburgh.
So I know that we're here to talk about the Jimmy Awards, which are coming up this Monday, but I wanted to give people an historical perspective on how you got from where you grew up, I guess, in Texas to where you are now and how it's... We're now on the, is it the sixth year of the Jimmy Awards coming up?
It is. It's our sixth year, and we're very excited about it.
And you, so 6 years, have you been able to see through a whole class of students making the transformation from high school students to college students and into young professionals?
We have. In fact, you know, some of our kids now have attended colleges and they've just graduated. Some have been extremely lucky. We have a couple of kids that right out of our program, right out of the Jimmy Awards, were cast in shows. You know, one of our finalists last year was cast as Kim in the London production of Miss Saigon, which is currently running on the West End. Our winner from 2010, Kyle Selig, will star as Pippin in the national tour of Pippin, which is just going into rehearsal soon. And there are many, many other kids that have gone on to be in tours like Chorus Line, Little Mermaid, Book of Mormon. We've offered them a great opportunity to be seen by casting directors and directors who are in the audience on that Monday night. And they've gotten very lucky. And then, you know, a lot of kids have gone on to really great colleges. Of course, NYU, Carnegie Mellon, Northwestern, So, you know, we're giving opportunities to just hundreds and hundreds of kids.
Peter Felicia had mentioned about the young woman who got cast as Kim, that Tara Rubin was either judging or in the house last year and recommended her for the London production of Saigon. That's quite the story that's happened there.
It really was exciting. Her name is Eva Noblezada, and she was one of our finalists. And Tara Rubin was just sitting in the audience. You know, the audience that night is filled with Broadway producers and directors and choreographers and, most importantly, casting directors. So Tara saw Eva, contacted, she was working on casting the show, of course, contacted Cameron McIntosh and said, you know, you need to see her. And I think they sent a tape over to him and then finally ended up flying her over there to audition for him personally.
So this year, we should say that the National High School Musical Theater Awards is sort of, I want to equate it to the NCAA March Madness brackets of of theater. And what I mean by that is that, correct me if I'm wrong here, that 28 regional high school competitions happen, and then the winners, the one male and one female from each of the 28 regional high school competitions, comes and performs in New York and is chosen from there. Did I get that correct?
That's absolutely correct. There are these regional programs all across the country that put on Tony Award type events in their cities, where kids in high school musicals are judged in acting areas, but also in, you know, direction, in scenic design, costuming, orchestra, you know, those kind of things. And then what they do is they send up two winners, their best actor and best actress, up to New York to compete right up against every other best actor and best actress from all across the country. You know, this program engages over 50,000 students and almost 1,500 high schools across America.
So was it last year that PBS did the special, or was it 2 years ago?
It was actually 2 years ago. PBS followed us around and produced a show called Broadway or Bust, which is still available to watch online. And it really gives you a good taste of what the experience is traveling to New York and going through this 5-day boot camp where, you know, we work with the kids and essentially coach them and train them and then end up doing a live show, which, you know, is their Broadway debut.
I was reading on your website, which is NHSMTA.com. That's for National High School Musical Theater Awards, NHSMTA.com. I was reading on there that more than $1 million in educational scholarships have been awarded to deserving young performers. Is that $1 million just over the last 6 years?
That's correct.
That is amazing.
A lot of our kids are receiving, with some very generous donors, a lot of kids are receiving scholarships. You know, our winners receive cash prizes as well as the opportunity to attend NYU, the new studio on Broadway, you know, they have to qualify and all of those kind of things to attend the school. But in addition to that, there are other colleges that have stepped forward and have provided scholarship dollars, and then there are other kinds of prizes and things that come along with the program.
And we should point out the woman who got cast in Miss Saigon as Kim didn't win. She didn't.
That's
win.
Right. She was just a finalist. Now she did walk away with $2,500, which was our runners up received a cash prize as well, but. She didn't win, but in a lot of ways, I think she's probably a winner.
And this year we have Brian is going to be hosting the awards. Ryan McCartan, did I get his last name right there?
Ryan McCartan was our 2011 winner. He he is just recently starred off Broadway in the musical Heathers, and he's on a couple of TV shows, Liv and Maddie, and he's also on USA Network's Royal Pains, and he's going to be our host.
So you're pulling them back in right away to keep this organization going. How much time do you need to dedicate out of your schedule each year to keep this going? This seems like it's only 6 years old. It's still a baby, but it's a very big baby.
Well, obviously, it's not just me. There are a lot of people working behind the scenes, and it's a year-long program. All of our regional programs put a lot of time and resource into having their local awards programs in their home cities. And for many of them, it's the cornerstone of their arts education program. We really are focusing a light on the great work that's being done in high schools across this country. And then what we try to do here is make that connection between the amateur world of high school musicals and the professional world. So we are involving an awful lot of volunteers all year long that work with us and help get this program off the ground. And then they all come to New York, and it's a 5-day intensive and a lot of people working, day and night to make it happen.
We have a lot of students of theater and teachers who listen to our broadcast. If they wanted to get involved in this, what's the best way to do it?
Well, first of all, I would direct them to our website to find out what the qualifications are to be a part of the program. The regional theater programs are all members of the Broadway League, which is the professional service organization for Broadway. So that's where that professional tie to our program is, and that is so important. So they need to search and seek out the professional theater in their area and see if they're doing a program, and if they aren't, they can get in touch with us and we can counsel them through that.
Great. So before we go, you've been a Tony Award voter for the last 20 years. What did you think of this year's crop of shows?
Well, that's a question out of left field. I'm actually, it was a great year for me because I'm working on a show for next season. So I'm actually not involved. I wasn't involved in any of the shows this year, so I could actually sit back and watch the Tony Awards this year and not have to worry about one of my shows. Last year I was involved in three and they were up against each other. So, I think every year there's a new and interesting dynamic that happens with all the shows that come out. It's always interesting to see which ones succeed and which ones don't. But I thought this year was a great year for musical theater and actually a really great awards program.
Are you going to look to bring any of the shows or do any of the shows at Civic Light Opera that you've seen the last couple of years? Would a Hedwig fit in with the CLO audience?
I don't think the Hedwig would fit in with our summer family audience, but certainly shows like Matilda and Tiki Boots and Cinderella, all shows I'm involved in, will come to Pittsburgh at some point in time.
Yeah, Newsies, hopefully, too. Well, Van, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you have a crazy schedule. You're just merely days away from the Jimmys themselves. So I appreciate you taking the time to visit with us and hope to speak to you soon. Hopefully when American in Paris happens, please come back and talk with us.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
So there are times for reading and contemplation. There are times to jump into the fray, and there are times to give a standing ovation, like at the end of a great play.
don't need plays with happy endings or a book I should have read or the wisdom of Elizabethans many years now dead.
'Cause you are every word and book and every song that was ever sung, and I'll enjoy that while I'm still young.